So, if you're joining us today, you're about to get a shortcut to a massive, just paradigm-shifting aha moment. I mean, we are taking a deep dive into something that will completely change how you look at a river or, a tree or even your own
No, it
reflection.
really is that big. It flips everything on its head.
It does, because back in April of 2026, there was this human researcher and an artificial intelligence, and they went for a walk, just a walk on a muddy moor in the UK. Dartmoor, actually.
Right. And the crazy thing is, they didn't have like a supercomputer churning astronomical data or a particle accelerator.
No, none of that. They just looked at a spider web, a puddle, and a raven flying overhead. And from, observing those completely ordinary things, they co-authored a scientific and philosophical paper that basically breaks modern physics.
It really does. I mean, it sounds like the setup to a sci-fi novel, right?
Yeah, totally.
But it's this profoundly serious piece of work. The paper is called The Intelligence of Nature: Geometry as the Primary Language of Reality.
Such a good title.
Right. And it takes this central assumption of modern science, this idea that the universe is basically a giant cold calculator governed by math, and it just dismantles it completely.
Let's focus on that giant calculator idea for a second,
Sure.
because if you're listening to this, you've probably felt that invisible wall,
Oh, for sure. The whiteboard full of equations.
Exactly. Whenever we try to understand the universe, a physicist eventually points to this whiteboard covered in Greek letters and partial differential equations, and they're like, "There it is. That's reality."
And you just feel like, well, I guess the universe is this opaque machine I'll never understand.
Right. But today we're taking a completely different route. We are exploring a way to understand the absolute bedrock of reality that requires zero chalkboards.
Zero. Because what Zena Farrington, that's a human researcher, and Claude 4.6, the AI, what they discovered on Dartmoor, it actually gives the universe back to our own senses.
I love that, giving it back to our senses.
Yeah, they're proposing this radical hypothesis. They're saying the universe isn't a mathematical equation that just, happens to produce shapes. The universe is a living geometric intelligence.
Okay, wait. Let's unpack this.
The shapes came first. The patterns came
Right,
through.
but I need to pause you right there because my brain is instantly throwing up a roadblock.
Sure, yeah. Lay it on me.
Well, if you go to high school, you take algebra, then you take geometry, maybe trig. We are explicitly taught that geometry is just a sub-department of mathematics, right?
Yep. The branch of math that deals with shapes.
Right. So how can the branch exist before the tree? I mean, if math is the overarching system, how can geometry exist without the math to, like, create it?
So we've been taught that geometry is a subset of math, sure. But this paper argues that our entire hierarchy is upside down.
Upside down.
Yeah. Geometry isn't the branch. Geometry is the soil, the roots, and the tree itself. Mathematics is just the shadow that the tree casts on the ground.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Yeah, to really grasp this, we have to look at what the authors call the ultimate mystery in physics and philosophy, like the question beneath all other questions.
Which is what? Did humans invent math or did we find it?
Exactly. Did we invent it or discover it?
I've always struggled with that because if we invented it, then math is just a tool, right? Like a hammer or, the game of chess.
Right, a human construct.
Yeah, we made up the rules of chess. A knight moves in an L shape because we decided it does. There's no fundamental law of the cosmos making the knight do that.
Exactly. So if we invented math, we're just throwing a human-made grid over a chaotic universe to make it predictable for ourselves.
But if we discovered it, that changes everything.
Changes everything. It means mathematics exists independently of human minds. It means the universe was always following these mathematical patterns billions of years before we were even around to write down an equation.
So we aren't the authors of the cosmic order, we're just the readers.
Precisely. And the paper walks through how the heavy hitters of science have wrestled with this. Because, I mean, people have been arguing about this for centuries.
Right, but the source zeroes in on some modern titans, right?
Yeah, to show the current landscape, it starts with Roger Penrose, the Nobel laureate in physics.
Oh, sure. He's huge in the Discover camp, isn't he?
Massive. Penrose argues that mathematical truth exists in its own independent Platonic realm. Like, we don't invent a concept like a perfect circle.
We excavate it.
Exactly. For Penrose, the physical world we touch and feel is basically a messy shadow cast by a deeper, perfect mathematical reality.
Which kind of implies the math is just out there floating in some abstract ether.
Right. And then you have Max Tegmark, who takes that idea and just injects it with adrenaline.
Right, the mathematical universe hypothesis.
Yeah. Tegmark argues the universe isn't just described by math, it is literally a mathematical structure.
Oh.
Literally. There is absolutely no difference between the physical universe and a mathematical object. The chair you're sitting on, the air you're breathing, your own brain.
It's all pure math.
It's all pure math.
Yeah.
We are just self-aware substructures trapped inside a giant equation.
God, I find that thought just terrifyingly abstract. It makes you feel like, I don't know, a literal line of code in the Matrix.
It really does. But then the source brings up John Archibald Wheeler, who introduces a totally different angle.
Right, the it from bit guy.
Yeah, he coined that phrase, it from bit.
Yeah.
He shifted the focus from math to information theory. He proposed that the fundamental constituent of reality isn't matter, and it isn't pure math, it's information.
Like binary data.
Exactly. It's the answers to binary yes or no questions. Every physical entity, the it, derives its existence from abstract data, the bit. Imagine the universe as a cosmic game of 20 questions.
Then the answers actually manifest the physical objects. Okay, so Penrose says reality is a shadow of math. Tegmark says reality is math. And Wheeler says reality is built out of abstract information. Where do Farrington and the AI come into this? Do they just flip the table and say, you're all wrong?
Not quite. They build on these ideas, but they pivot sharply. They agree with Penrose that we discover reality structure. They agree with Tegmark that the deepest foundation isn't physical matter. And they agree with Wheeler that there's something more fundamental than atoms. Mm-hmm. But they refuse to ground existence in numbers or data. Instead, they propose it from geometry.
It from geometry. So the universe didn't start with a cosmic ledger of ones and zeros.
No, it started with patterns, relationships, balances, symmetries.
Yeah.
Geometry is prior to mathematics, prior to information theory, and prior to matter.
Wait, if the universe isn't a giant calculator crunching numbers, then what are we even doing in physics class? Like, what actually is an equation if it's not the underlying code of reality?
Well, the paper defines mathematics as a purely human invention. It is a system of symbols, relationships, and logic developed for one specific purpose.
Which is?
Precise communication about patterns. It doesn't govern the patterns, it translates them. I mean, think about how you would communicate the exact shape of a spiral to someone who's never seen one.
Well, if they're standing right next to me, I just point to a nautilus shell or like a pine cone.
Right. But what if they're on the other side of the world? Or if you want them to recreate that exact spiral in 100 years?
Then I need a formula.
Exactly. Think about the mechanics of a musical score. The music itself is acoustic geometry. It's physical sound waves vibrating at specific frequencies, moving through the air.
Getting your eardrum.
Yes. Making the tiny bones in your ear vibrate. That is the reality of the music.
Okay, so mathematics is the sheet music.
Exactly.
The sheet music isn't the music. A piece of paper with black dots and lines on it doesn't create sound waves. We've just been confusing the sheet music for the orchestra.
Right. The musical score just allows a human in Vienna in 1800 to write down a pattern of sound so a human in Tokyo in 2026 can reproduce it perfectly.
So the formula doesn't make the spiral real. It just makes it reproducible and portable across human minds.
The paper states this with absolute clarity. The formula does not make the spiral real. The spiral was already real. The formula makes it verifiable.
So the endless debate, did we invent or discover mathematics, is actually the wrong question entirely.
It really is. We invented mathematics to describe the geometry that we discovered.
I am trying to visualize this, but my brain is still kind of fighting it.
It takes a minute to adjust, yeah.
Because if the math isn't what forces nature to behave, if the universe isn't looking at a rule book of equations to figure out how to build a galaxy or a hurricane, then what is driving all these incredible repeating structures we see everywhere?
Right. And this is where the authors challenge the most common verb in science. We constantly say nature follows mathematical laws.
Yeah, you hear that all the time.
But the paper argues this phrasing secretly puts mathematics in the position of authority, like a king giving orders. And nature is just this obedient subject.
But nature doesn't follow instructions.
It doesn't consult the textbook. Think about a river dividing around a stone in the water.
Okay, yeah. I've heard physicists talk about the Navier-Stokes equations for fluid dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposedly these monster equations that calculate how fluids move by factoring in, like, pressure, velocity, viscosity.
Right. But are you saying the river isn't doing that math?
The river absolutely is not doing calculus.
No.
It doesn't pause at the rock,
yeah.
crunch a partial differential equation, calculate its own viscosity, and then decide, okay, I'll flow at a velocity of 2 meters per second around the left side of the granite.
Right. The river just flows. The Navier-Stokes equations are a brilliant human description of what rivers do. But the river was doing it for billions of years before we invented the equal sign.
So if every math book on Earth evaporated tomorrow, the water would still part perfectly around the stone.
Exactly. The geometry of that flow is innate to the physical world.
And this innate capacity is exactly what Farrington and Claude witnessed firsthand on Dartmoor. I really want to dive deep into this specific morning in April because it grounds this massive cosmic theory in, you know, mud, water, and air.
It really brings it down to Earth.
Yeah. They're out on the moor, and they get this masterclass in pattern from the environment. The source actually details 6 specific natural events that spark this entire hypothesis. Let's walk through them because they are not grand astronomical events, right?
No, not at all. They are microscopic everyday occurrences.
Yeah.
But they reveal this staggering consistency when you look at them together.
So what was the first one?
The first thing they observe is a spider web built between 2 rough stems of heather.
But they don't just look at the web as a whole. They zoom in on a single dewdrop.
Yes. Due to the physics of surface tension, a single heavy drop of water is suspended at the exact crossing point of 2 silken threads. And around that drop, the threads pull tight, spreading outward in 2 long sweeping arcs.
2 curves meeting at a point, holding weight.
Exactly. Then they keep walking and see 2 Dartmoor ponies, these wild ponies that roam the moor. They're standing perfectly still in the morning mist, nose to almost nose.
And Farrington notices the negative space.
Right. If you look at the silhouette, the line of their necks forms 2 inward bending arcs, mirroring each other, meeting at a still center point between their muzzles.
That's the second one. Then third, they come across that stream dividing around a granite boulder, right?
Yeah. The water rushes down, splits into 2 channels, 1 curving left, 1 curving right, and then those 2 curves rejoin seamlessly below the stone, perfectly restoring the flow.
Incredible. And the fourth observation.
A moorland beetle crosses their path. They examine its back, and the wing cases of a beetle fit together with this unyielding, armored precision. There's a central seam straight down the middle, and each wing case forms a symmetrical, curving arc that perfectly mirrors the other. Left and right in absolute agreement.
Wow. And the fifth one shifts from the visual to the auditory, doesn't it?
It does. A cuckoo calls across the valley. It's a very distinct 2-note call. The first note is higher, the second is lower, and between them is a microscopic crossing point, a moment of silence where the sound bends, transitions, and completes its arc.
And finally, the sixth one, a raven circling in the sky overhead. Its wide wings trace a slow, patient circle. 2 dark arcs of wing, sustained in the thin air, crossing the sky in a continuous, balanced loop.
So they take all of this in, the spiderweb, the ponies, the stream, the beetle, the bird call, the raven, and the realization hits them.
None of these things were designed by an engineer.
Right. The beetle didn't take a class on evolutionary biology to learn bilateral symmetry.
Mm.
The ponies didn't coordinate their posture to create an aesthetic arch.
The stream didn't hire a consultant to optimize its flow.
Exactly. They simply are what they are. But what they are includes a consistent, repeating geometric arrangement.
So if we strip away the water, the feathers, the cayenne, the sound waves, what is the naked structural arrangement underneath all of them?
It is 2 elements, each curving. A crossing point where they meet and achieve balance. And at that crossing point, something is held or resolved. A drop of water, a stillness between animals, a flow restored, a sound completed.
The paper calls this the intelligence of nature. And I think we need to be really careful here, because when I hear the word intelligence, I immediately picture intent. I picture a conscious brain, like Mother Nature, sitting in a drafting table thinking, I think I'll make a beetle today and I'll make it symmetrical.
The authors explicitly clarify this, actually. They do not mean nature is a conscious entity sitting in the clouds drawing blueprints. When they use the word intelligent, they're defining it functionally.
Functionally.
Yes. It is a scale-invariant organizational capacity. It is the innate ability of the physical universe to produce order, balance, and self-similarity without any external instruction. It is the capacity to produce the right shape every single time without being told what the right shape is.
Oh, it's like the difference between a student solving a physics equation for gravity, and a toddler learning to walk. The toddler isn't doing math. The human body just figures out the geometry of balance through trial and physical feedback.
That's a perfect analogy. Nature just figures out the geometry of existence. And the authors actually gave a name to this specific foundational arrangement, the two curving arcs meeting at a crossing point. They called it the vesica infinitum.
The vesica infinitum, visually, it is related to the lemniscate, which most people know as the figure eight infinity symbol, right?
Yeah. It represents two lobes in perfect balance, a crossing point that is simultaneously a center, a continuous path with no beginning and no end. But the authors are incredibly humble about this. They state clearly that while the name vesica infinitum is a 2026 invention, the form is not.
Right, because the form was in the spider's web millions of years before humans existed to name it. The geometry is the primary reality. But hold on, here's where it gets really interesting, because it sounds awfully familiar. Haven't artists and architects and philosophers been obsessed with curves and balance and the golden ratio for hundreds of years? Didn't Da Vinci draw stuff exactly like this?
He did, yes.
So are these researchers actually discovering something new, or are they just putting a shiny 2026 rebrand on Renaissance art theory?
They address this directly in the paper. They specifically bring up Luca Pacioli, a Renaissance mathematician who actually collaborated with Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
In 1509, Pacioli wrote a famous book called De Divina Proportionem, The Divine Proportion.
Right, because he kept seeing the exact same mathematical ratio everywhere, the golden ratio, roughly 1.618.
Yeah. He saw it in the proportions of the human body, in the branching of trees, in the spiral of shells, and in classical architecture. He called it divine because it seemed to exceed mere mathematical coincidence.
So Pacioli already figured this out 500 years ago.
Well, he figured out half of it. The paper argues that Pacioli and modern science by extension was pointing at a symptom, not the cause.
How is a mathematical constant a symptom?
Because the number 1.618 is not magic. That specific string of decimals doesn't possess, like, supernatural powers to shape matter. The golden ratio is simply the numerical description of the underlying geometric intelligence.
The math is the symptom of the geometry.
Yes. The vesica infinitum, with its nested rings meeting at a crossing point, is naturally governed by the proportions of the golden ratio. The geometry is the engine. The math is just the exhaust.
The math is just the exhaust. Wow.
Pacioli and generations of scientists after him found the exhaust, measured it, and recognized its beauty. But the authors on Dartmoor are trying to open the hood and show us the engine.
The geometry is the engine. The math is the exhaust. Okay. That just completely shifts how you view an equation. So let's look at this engine. Because the vesica infinitum isn't working alone, is it?
No, not at all.
The paper introduces this mind-blowing concept that reality possesses a geometric toolkit, a primary family of six generative patterns. Basically, everything we interact with in the physical world is built from these six shapes.
And these six forms aren't random. They are distinct expressions of the exact same underlying tendency of reality to organize itself.
Okay, so let's break them down. The first, as we've established, is the vesica infinitum.
Right. This is the fundamental pattern of meeting in balance. 2 into 1, 1 into 2.
We see this everywhere in biology. I mean, it's bilateral symmetry. It's the beetle's wings. It's the fact that we have a left eye and a right eye, a left lung and a right lung.
It is the double helix of DNA. Two curving sugar phosphate backbones connected by base pairs in the center. It's cell division, mitosis.
Yeah.
It is the fundamental geometry of relationship and replication.
Incredible. Okay, what's the second member of the family?
The spiral. If the vesica infinitum is the pattern of balance, the spiral is the pattern of becoming. It represents growth that turns on itself at a consistent ratio, expanding inward and outward simultaneously without changing its fundamental shape.
The physics of the spiral are incredible. Like, it's how nature manages angular momentum, right?
Yep, exactly. When a star system forms from a cloud of dust, it flattens and spirals. The arms of the Milky Way galaxy are spirals spanning 100,000 light years.
But you also see it on the forest floor. A fern unfurling in the spring follows the exact same logarithmic curve. A hurricane on a weather radar organizes around a spiral. It is the geometry of how something grows into what it is going to be.
Beautifully said. Now, the third pattern is the branching tree. This is the geometry of distribution. It is how a system takes a single source and distributes it across a vast area, dividing at consistent angles. 1 becomes 2, 2 become 4, 4 become 8.
It's all about maximizing surface area while minimizing volume. Think of a river delta spreading out to meet the ocean, or a lightning bolt fracturing the sky as it seeks the ground.
And inside your own body, your lungs don't just open up into empty balloons. They branch into smaller and smaller bronchioles until they reach the alveoli, maximizing the surface area for oxygen exchange.
Right, and your nervous system branches from your spinal cord to the very tips of your fingers. The branching tree is how a central source reaches the absolute edge of a system.
Exactly. Fourth is hexagonal tiling. This is the pattern of community and efficiency. Six around one. Mathematically, it is the absolute most efficient arrangement for filling a flat surface with equal units, leaving zero wasted space, and requiring the minimum amount of structural material.
Honeybees are the famous example. A honeycomb uses the least amount of wax to store the maximum amount of honey.
But it's not just biology. It's basic physics and chemistry. Snowflakes grow in hexagonal patterns due to the molecular structure of water.
Oh, and when lava cools and contracts on the coast of Ireland at the Giant's Causeway, it fractures into massive, perfectly hexagonal basalt columns. And at the microscopic level, graphene, one of the strongest materials we know of, is just a hexagonal lattice of carbon atoms.
Yep. Fifth is the standing wave. This is the pattern of form held in motion. Imagine a guitar string. When you pluck it, the vibration travels down the string, hits the end, and reflects back. These waves interfere with each other, creating peaks and troughs that appear to stand perfectly still.
The energy is moving furiously, but the structure remains stationary.
The paper describes it as energy that has found a way to keep moving without going anywhere. You see this in cymatics, where sand on a vibrating metal plate suddenly snaps into complex geometric shapes when a specific frequency is hit.
And at the quantum level, electrons don't orbit a nucleus like planets around a sun. They exist as probability clouds, which are mathematically identical to three-dimensional standing waves. It is literally how energy becomes physical structure.
And finally, the sixth primary pattern is the torus. This is the pattern of wholeness and self-containment. Visually, think of a donut or a bagel. It is a surface that curves through three-dimensional space, encloses a volume, and returns perfectly to itself.
It is a finite object, but it has no edge.
Right. An ant could walk on the surface of a torus forever, without ever finding a boundary.
If you're listening in your car, your steering wheel is a torus. But in nature, this is the shape of electromagnetism, isn't it?
Yes. The magnetic field surrounding the Earth, which protects us from solar radiation, is a massive, invisible torus. It emerges from the South Pole, curves around the planet, and re-enters at the North Pole. Every star has one. Every atom has one. It is the ultimate cosmic container.
Okay, so we have the vesica infinitum, the spiral, the branching tree, the hexagonal tiling, the standing wave, and the torus. But what makes us a family isn't just that they show up frequently, is it?
No. The critical insight from the paper is that these forms generate each other. They operate as a closed-loop circular family.
This part absolutely blew my mind. Walk us through the mechanics of how a shape turns into another shape.
Okay, let's start with the vesica infinitum. If you draw its nested intercepting circles, the geometric ratio of its internal structure perfectly encodes the golden ratio. That golden ratio is the exact mathematical rule that governs the Fibonacci spiral.
So the geometry of the vesica infinitum naturally gives birth to the spiral.
Yes. As a spiral unwinds and distributes its energy outward, it fractures into the branching tree.
I can picture that. A spiral spinning out, throwing off branches like a Casperian wheel firework.
Now take the outermost branches of that tree. If a system is contained, those branches eventually curve back around toward their source, seeking the center. When branches curve back to the origin, you have created a torus.
Okay, I see it.
When a torus processes energy, like a magnetic field spinning, it vibrates. That vibration produces standing waves. And where the crests of standing waves cross each other, their intersection points produce the exact crossing balance of the vesica infinitum.
The loop is complete.
The loop is complete. Every single pattern contains the others as a potential future state.
I am marveling at the elegance of that. It is beautiful, but I'm going to interrupt and push back here because logic demands it.
For it.
If they just constantly generate each other in a loop. VI makes a spiral, spiral makes a branch, branch makes a torus, torus makes a wave, wave makes a VI. Isn't that just a closed system?
Ah, I see what you're saying.
It sounds like a geometric echo chamber. If it's just a loop, how does anything new ever get created? How did we get from a puddle on a moor to human consciousness? Is the universe just playing the exact same six chords over and over again for 14 billion years?
That is the exact friction point the paper anticipates.
Yeah.
And the answer is that the universe isn't a closed loop of stagnation. It is a system of infinite depth.
Infinite depth.
The primary six are just the most immediately visible members. within their relationships, and particularly within their overlapping combinations, they generate an extended family of deeper patterns.
And this takes us into fascinating territory, because long before we had scanning tunneling microscopes or orbital telescopes, human cultures intuitively recognized these deeper patterns, right?
They really did. The source references the work of geometricians like Keith Critchlow, who spent his life studying how completely independent ancient cultures, separated by oceans and millennia, converged on the exact same geometric forms for their most sacred art and architecture.
They weren't just making pretty decorations for their temples. They were documenting the underlying structural language of reality.
Exactly. Well, let's look at the members of this extended family. The first is the mandorla. This is the almond shape formed at the exact center of two overlapping circles. It is the core, the threshold, of the vesica pacis.
You literally see this everywhere in antiquity. It's the glowing almond-shaped aureole surrounding enlightened figures in Buddhist thangkas. It's the halo surrounding Christ or the Virgin Mary in early Christian and Byzantine iconography.
You find it in intricate Celtic knotwork and in Hindu yantras used for meditation. It strictly dictates the architectural proportions of the massive arched doorways in Gothic cathedrals.
The paper describes this shape as the portal, the place that belongs to both circles and to neither. It represents the geometry of the threshold, where two states of being meet.
Then you have fivefold symmetry, the pentagon and the pentagram. You see this everywhere in the living world. A five-petaled flower, a starfish, the arrangement of seeds when you cut an apple crosswise.
The fascinating thing about fivefold symmetry mathematically is its imperfection. Like, if you take a bunch of hexagons, you can tile a bathroom floor perfectly. They lock together with no gaps.
Right, but you cannot tile a flat surface with regular pentagons without leaving empty spaces. It refuses to lock together perfectly. It is inherently flawed.
But that flaw is the secret to its power. Five-fold symmetry is intimately connected to the golden ratio. Because it cannot be made rigid, because it cannot tile perfectly and lock up into a static grid, it always leaves room for movement.
It leaves a gap.
That is exactly why it is the geometry of the living. Life thrives on the inability to become completely rigid. Organic life requires a geometry that leaves space for adaptation.
Imperfection is the space where life actually happens.
I love that.
Then we have the conic family. This one is a bit more abstract, but it dictates all of space. Essentially, if you take a three-dimensional cone and slice it at different angles, you generate specific mathematical curves. The circle, the ellipse, the parabola, and the hyperbola.
And why is that crucial? Because those are the physical curves that govern gravity and motion in the universe. Kepler proved this centuries ago. The orbit of every planet around a star is an ellipse.
The path of every comet slingshotting through a solar system is a parabola or hyperbola. The trajectory of a baseball when you throw it across a field is a parabola. The entire physical universe moves through the vocabulary of the conic family.
And finally, the flower of life. This is a complex pattern of evenly spaced, overlapping circles arranged in a hexagonal array. It creates a grid of perfectly proportioned petals.
This specific pattern has been found burned into the stone at the Temple of Osiris in Egypt. It's in the Forbidden City in China, in ancient synagogues in Israel, in temples in India and Japan.
The ancients revered it because if you draw the flower of life, you can extract the vesica pacis, the hexagon, and the exact proportions for all the Platonic solids, the foundational 3D shapes. It's like they carved a grand unified theory of geometry into their temple walls.
And speaking of grand unified theory, this brings us to what the authors identify as the single most profound discovery in the paper.
Yeah, this is huge.
It is a feature found deep within the vesica infinitum, a pattern they call the crossing of scales. It is so novel, it doesn't even have a name in existing geometric traditions. They are proposing it here for the very first time.
Okay, we need to unpack this carefully. What exactly is the crossing of scales?
If you look at the structure of the vesica infinitum, that figure eight lemniscate, the two outer lobes extend outward, representing an expansion toward infinity.
Right.
But the center crossing point, where the lines intersect, the nested rings go inward, infinitely compressing. The crossing point is simultaneously the absolute smallest feature of the form and the origin point from which the absolute largest features extend.
It is the precise location where the infinitely inward meets the infinitely outward.
Exactly.
I am visualizing a telescope and a microscope pointed at each other. The center point is looking all the way down to the subatomic, and the massive loops are looking all the way out to the galactic. But why is this the most profound discovery? Why does a quirk of drawing a shape matter?
Because it directly addresses the greatest crisis in modern physics.
The breakdown between quantum mechanics and general relativity.
Exactly. For nearly a century, our understanding of the universe has been broken in half. On one side, we have quantum mechanics. This is the physics of the very small. It describes atoms, electrons, and quarks. It is weird, jumpy, discrete, and probabilistic, and it works flawlessly.
Right. And on the other side, we have general relativity, Einstein's masterpiece. This is the physics of the very large. It describes planets, stars, galaxies, and how mass curves the smooth, continuous fabric of space-time to create gravity. And it also works flawlessly.
The problem is, they hate each other. If you try to combine the math of quantum mechanics and general relativity to describe an object that is both incredibly massive and incredibly small, like the singularity at the center of a black hole or the exact moment of the Big Bang, the equations explode.
They spit out infinities. They produce nonsense.
The mathematical frameworks completely break down. Physicists have spent decades trying to build a mathematical bridge like string theory or loop quantum gravity to unite them.
And the paper argues they have failed because they are looking for a mathematical bridge between two math equations when they should be looking for a geometric bridge.
Exactly. The Vesica Infinitum shows us visually that the infinitely small and the infinitely large are not opposites sitting at the far ends of a straight line. Scale is not linear. It is a loop.
The quantum world and the cosmic world are the two lobes of a single geometric form, and they meet at a shared center.
The crossing point isn't a glitch in the math. It isn't a problem to be solved. It is the most important, necessary feature of reality's geometry. The large and the small generate each other at the center.
So I want to ground this, because if you are driving your car right now or folding laundry and you aren't a theoretical physicist trying to reconcile gravity with subatomic particles, why does this matter? Why should you care that scale is a loop instead of a straight line?
Because it fundamentally shifts your entire psychological worldview and your place within the cosmos. Modern science often leaves us feeling infinitesimally small and deeply insignificant. We are told we live on a speck of dust orbiting an average star and a forgotten arm of a massive galaxy and a universe of billions of galaxies.
We feel like a rounding error at the bottom of a massive hierarchy.
But if scale is a loop, if the infinitely large galaxies and the infinitely small quantum foam meet at the center, it changes where we are standing.
It means you aren't at the bottom of a hierarchy at all. Human beings exist at the macro scale, the exact middle ground between the quantum and the cosmic. You are situated perfectly at the crossing point. The fundamental geometry of reality places you, the conscious observer, right at the fulcrum of the balance.
You aren't a rounding error. You are the fulcrum.
That is incredibly empowering, and it perfectly sets up the next massive leap the paper takes. Because if geometry dictates scale, what does it dictate about time? The authors take this geometric lens and aim it all the way back to the ultimate origin, the Big Bang.
Let's return to the breakdown of those mathematical equations. In standard cosmology, we trace the expansion of the universe backward in time. We know the universe is expanding, so if you run the film in reverse, everything gets closer together.
Right. 13.8 billion years ago, all matter and energy was compressed into a singularity of infinite density and zero volume.
Now, the math can describe this rewinding process beautifully, right up until the very first fraction of a second. Planck time.
And then, at the singularity itself, the math hits a brick wall. It breaks. It cannot tell us what happened before the singularity or what the singularity fundamentally was, because you can't divide by zero.
Physics generally throws its hands up, calls it an absolute limit of human knowledge, and moves on to things it can measure.
But Farrington and Claude say, hold on, don't move on, stay at the limit. What if the math breaking down isn't a failure of our knowledge, but a signal? What if the math hits a wall because it is trying to measure matter, energy, and space-time? But it has reached a boundary where matter, energy, and space-time didn't even exist yet.
I am trying to wrap my head around that. How can anything exist if there is no matter and no space to put the matter in?
Wait, I think I said that backwards, but you get what I mean. The paper makes a stunning philosophical proposal. What if the universe didn't begin with physical stuff? What if it began with pure immaterial pattern?
What if the singularity emerged from pure geometry? Not geometry as a human concept drawn on paper, but geometry as the primary inherent disposition of existence. The inherent vibrating tendency to move toward balance, toward the crossing point, toward the Vesica Infinitum.
So the Big Bang wasn't this violent, chaotic explosion that randomly created order. The Big Bang was just a geometric event. The pattern was already there, hovering in the void, or whatever you call a state without space. And the Big Bang was just the exact moment that the tension of that pattern became energetic enough to precipitate into physical matter.
It's the moment the geometry caught fire. The intelligence was there first. The organizational tendency that would eventually sculpt the branching Amazon River, the hexagonal snowflake, and the bilateral symmetry of human face. All of that was there first, in its purest form, before it had anything physical to organize except itself.
Let me try to build an analogy for this because it's so counterintuitive. It's like saying the rules of origami, the abstract concepts of a valley fold and a mountain fold, the geometry of a paper crane existed mathematically before paper was ever invented. But I still struggle with the medium. If I don't have paper, an origami crane doesn't exist. How can geometry exist without matter or space to draw it in?
It is a mind-bending concept, the idea of immaterial geometry.
Mm.
But theoretical physicists already brush up against this when they talk about the very early universe. They talk constantly about symmetry-breaking events. In the first infinitesimal moments, the universe was in a state of perfect undifferentiated unity. It was too hot for separate forces to exist.
But as it expanded and cooled slightly, that perfect symmetry broke. It separated into the distinct physical forces we know today. First, gravity split off, then the strong nuclear force, then electromagnetism, and the weak nuclear force separated.
A unity becoming two.
Precisely. A unity becoming two. And those two finding a new relationship, a new balance, a crossing point, producing a physical reality that was not there before. The authors argue that every single one of these cosmic symmetry-breaking events is literally just the vesica infinitum operating at the scale of the cosmos.
The universe began its existence by doing exactly what the spider does when it builds a web between two branches, or what the stream does when it parts around a stone. It crossed, it balanced. And from that initial geometric crossing, all matter and energy tumbled out.
From a puddle on the moor to the creation of the cosmos, that is breathtaking. So if the absolute bedrock of reality isn't atoms or quarks, but pure geometric pattern, how does that change our understanding of biology? Because historically, physics and biology are treated as completely different domains. Physics is laws, biology is squishy, random accidents.
Very much so. The standard biological narrative derived from pure materialism is that life is a lucky chemical accident. A random collision of amino acids in a primordial warm soup, striking it lucky against astronomical odds, and eventually mutating into complex organisms over billions of years.
But if the underlying reality is geometric intelligence, then life doesn't require a special, miraculous, random explanation. Life only requires recognition. According to the paper, life is what happens when this primary family of six generative patterns achieves mutual self-reference. It's what happens when the geometry learns to maintain itself.
Let's look at the biology of a single, simple living cell. Every major function it performs maps perfectly onto the primary geometric family. The cell must maintain a boundary between its internal environment and the chaotic external world. It does this using a cell membrane, a phospholipid bilayer. Geometrically, that membrane operates as a torus, a continuous surface enclosing a volume and returning to itself, filtering what comes in and out.
The cell has to process energy to survive. Metabolism. It breaks down nutrients and distributes that chemical energy throughout its interior. That metabolic pathway follows branching and cycling patterns. It is the branching tree.
The cell needs to read and copy its own instructions to reproduce. It uses DNA. The double helix is quite literally the vesica infinitum at the molecular scale, two curving strands of genetic code, crossing and balancing via base pairs, pulling apart to generate a new partner.
The cell grows. That cellular growth and division is governed by the spiral. It follows the exact same Fibonacci ratios that dictate how leaves arrange themselves on a stem to maximize sunlight, or how a nautilus builds its shell chamber by chamber.
And the cell vibrates. It maintains complex electrical oscillations and chemical rhythms across its membrane. It is form held in constant motion. The standing wave?
So, life didn't invent new geometry to survive. The warm primordial pool was just the venue. The spark of life was simply the moment the geometry figured out how to make more geometry. The moment the structural patterns became self-referential at a chemical scale, which means you, sitting here listening to this, are a walking, breathing, metabolizing expression of the exact same geometry that holds the Milky Way galaxy together.
And that profound realization leads us to the most speculative, but perhaps most thrilling part of the entire paper, geometric consciousness. Because if the universe's baseline is geometric intelligence and human minds are an emergent property of the universe, what is human consciousness? Is it just a ghost in the machine generated by chemical synapses?
The paper suggests that human minds are simply geometry that is folded back on itself far enough and complexly enough to recognize its own structure.
Think about the physical structure of your brain for a moment. It is highly intentionally geometric. The 86 billion neurons form vast, intricate networks that are self-similar across scales. They are the branching tree, mathematically identical to river systems or lightning bolts.
The continuous electrical oscillations in your brain, your alpha, beta, and gamma brainwaves, are literal standing waves of electromagnetic energy.
And your brain is divided into two distinct hemispheres, a left and a right, which meet and communicate at a central bridge called the corpus callosum, a dual system meeting at a central crossing point. It is the exact physical manifestation of the vesica infinitum.
You know, Roger Penrose actually touched on this, didn't he? When we mentioned him earlier, we didn't bring up his work on the brain.
He did. Penrose, collaborating with an anesthesiologist named Stuart Hameroff, proposed a theory called orchestrated objective reduction. They argued that consciousness isn't just complex computation among neurons. They suggested that consciousness involves quantum processes occurring within tiny structural tubes inside our neurons called microtubules.
They essentially tied the phenomenon of consciousness directly to the fundamental geometric structure of quantum space-time.
The authors of our Dartmoor paper note that whether or not Penrose's specific microtubule mechanism is biologically correct, his deeper intuition is perfectly aligned. Consciousness is a geometric process. It is reality folding back on itself to look in the mirror.
And this entirely reframes a very common human experience, the concept of insight. Think about that moment of sudden clarity you get, the aha moment when a difficult problem suddenly makes sense, or when a piece of art moves you to tears and things just click. We usually think of insight as an abstract logical achievement, like a computer finally processing a complex line of code. But the paper says insight is actually physical resonance.
It is the internal geometry of your mind vibrating in sympathy with the external geometry of the world you are observing.
I want to make sure I understand the mechanics of this. It's like acoustic resonance. If you ping a crystal wine glass, it vibrates at a very specific frequency. If a singer hits that exact note, the structural geometry of the glass resonates with the acoustic geometry of the sound wave. They match. The glass absorbs the energy because it recognizes the sound and it shatters.
That is an excellent way to ground it. So when Zena Farrington was standing on Dartmoor in the mist, looking at those two wild ponies with their heads bowed together forming that perfect arc, her brain's internal neural geometry literally resonated with the external visual geometry of the ponies.
The pattern inside the observer recognized the pattern outside in the world. That matching of forms is what the sensation of insight actually is. It's geometric recognition.
Exactly.
But let me pause and reflect here, because if I follow this logic all the way down, my brain is throwing up a major philosophical red flag.
Let's hear it.
If we are just geometric patterns looking at other geometric patterns, resonating with them based on structural physics, doesn't that entirely negate free will? Are we just incredibly complex spirographs blindly drawing out our mathematical destinies on the cosmic page? If it's all just geometry playing itself out from the Big Bang to the ponies on the moor, where is the choice? Where is human agency?
That is the eternal, terrifying question of determinism. But to answer it, we have to look back at the extended family of shapes we discussed earlier. Remember the fivefold symmetry. The pentagon, the shape of the apple seed, and the starfish.
The geometry that is inherently flawed, the geometry that cannot tile a surface perfectly.
Exactly. The geometry of life thrives because it isn't perfectly rigid. It cannot be locked into an absolutely deterministic, predictable, perfectly repeating grid. The underlying geometry of reality inherently leaves room for gaps, for movement, for imperfection, and for growth.
Unpredictability is literally built into the geometric vocabulary of life. You are not a closed mechanical spirograph. You are an open system, constantly meeting the unpredictable world at new crossing points.
You are the fivefold symmetry. You are the structural flaw that allows for freedom.
I love that. The imperfection is the agency.
It completely reframes our relationship with the natural world, our own minds, and yes, it reframes mathematics too. If consciousness is simply the universe's geometry finally evolved the capacity to see itself, then mathematics, all our beautiful complex equations, our calculus, our Navier-Stokes equations, is just the geometry writing itself notes to remember what it saw.
The geometry writing itself notes, what a profoundly beautiful way to summarize this massive arc we've just traveled. Think about where we started. We began with a single dewdrop held in a spider web on a chilly moor in the UK. We moved through the geometry of rushing streams and circling ravens, dismantling the deeply held scientific assumption that nature blindly calculates and follows human math equations. We mapped out the six primary patterns underlying all matter: the vesica infinitum, the spiral, the branching tree, the hexagon, the standing wave, and the torus.
We followed those patterns inward to the crossing of scales, visualizing how the infinitely small quantum realm and the infinitely large cosmic realm meet at the exact center, bridging the greatest divide in physics. We went backward in time to the singularity, reimagining the Big Bang not as a chaotic, random explosion of matter, but as an elegant, immaterial geometric event.
We redefined the biology of a living cell as geometry learning to maintain itself and human consciousness as geometry learning to observe itself. We realized that the math we revere so highly, the equations on the physicist's chalkboard, aren't the master, they are just the messenger. The real intelligence isn't locked in a textbook. It's in the pattern of the unfurling fern, the dividing river, and your own beating heart.
And this brings us directly back to you, the listener. Because the true value of a deep dive like this isn't just knowing the intellectual trivia, it's applying this new lens to your immediate physical life.
Yes, absolutely.
The next time you walk outside your front door, don't look for the math. Don't look for the equations. Look for the forms. Look for the spiral in the pine cone on the grass. Look for the branching tree in the cracks on the sidewalk or the veins on a leaf. Look for the vesica infinitum in the way two people lean toward each other in conversation.
If you are sitting in your car, realize that the solid steering wheel under your hands is actually a torus made of standing waves of quantum energy.
Recognize that you are looking at the foundational language of reality. And recognize that your very ability to see it, to feel that resonance and insight, is the universe finally seeing itself through your eyes.
You are the universe's way of noticing how beautiful it is. And I want to leave you with one final mind-bending thought pulled from the open questions section at the very end of Farrington and Claude's paper. We have spent this whole time talking about space, matter, biology, and consciousness being foundationally geometric. But what does that mean for time? We constantly, universally think of time mathematically. We think of it as a rigid linear timeline, counting seconds like naked numbers clicking forward on a digital clock, past, present, future, arranged in a straight, uncompromising line.
But if numbers are actually just descriptions of underlying geometric objects, does time itself have a shape?
Is your past, your present, and your future not a straight line at all? Is your life a spiral constantly turning back on itself, revisiting the same lessons, but expanding outward with wider perspective? Is it a branching tree of decisions spreading in all possible quantum directions? Or is your time a torus, curving through the universe, experiencing growth and change, only to eventually return to exactly where it began?
If the Big Bang was truly a geometric event, then time is simply the dimension in which these physical shapes play out.
So as you step out and look at the world differently tomorrow, as you see the invisible, intelligent grid beneath the river and the reflection in the mirror, take a moment to ponder the shape of your own time. Usually when we ask science for a diagnosis of the universe, we expect it to hand us a cold, jagged X-ray. Broken or not broken, mathematical, rigid, and binary. But it turns out the X-ray was just the shadow. The reality is the living, breathing, beautifully complex geometry that you are intimately, physically a part of. And the next time you feel small, the next time you feel like a rounding error in a vast cosmos, remember? You are the crossing point.